Good morning. Our next case this morning is A20077, Nelson v. Nelson. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument, and then the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So as soon as you're ready, just approach the microphone in the center and tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Boulette, here on behalf of appellant Marlo Nelson. The district court well understood the problem it was trying to solve. In the district court's words, it found it inequitable that the current child support doesn't track with the time dad's exercising and hadn't at that time exercised in over a year, now over 2 years. What the district court misunderstood was the solution that statute provided to it to modify child support and apply the parenting time expense adjustment consistent with the time Mr. Nelson will likely spend with the children moving forward. While family law is typically the realm of discretionary review and abuse of discretion, what we have before this court today are two purely legal issues: the application of two statutes, 518A36, which is the parenting time expense adjustment statute, and 518A39, which is the modification statute. I'm going to walk the court beginning with 36 because truly that's where all the action in this appeal is, to be really colloquial about it. If the arguments for 36, if the court disagrees with our interpretation of 518A36, there is no need to reach the issues in 518A39 because those all depend on the appropriate application of the expense adjustment. But fundamentally, right, child support asks district courts to run through a series of reasonably complex formulas to end with what we call a net child support obligation, consisting of basic support, medical support, child care support. As part of reaching that concretized final number, what the guidelines do is to provide credit to parents for the time they will likely spend with their children over the course of the calendar year. It does that based on the legislature's belief and presumption that when parents are caring for their children, they have costs. They pay for food, they pay for clothing, they pay for school supplies and lunches and all the rest. And in order to help district courts turn those costs, which can be inchoate and difficult to determine, into a fixed number, statute, specifically 518A36, gives us a formula. And that formula exists specifically in 518A36, subdivision 2B.
Mr. Millett, can I intervene? I know just because time is short. Referencing subdivision 2 and as well as subdivision 1A, I'm wondering how those interrelate. And I guess another way of saying that is, I mean, do the provisions of 1A essentially describe the formula that is laid out in subdivision 2?
I don't believe they do, Judge Johnson.
And if that's so, then what is the purpose of subdivision 1A?
I think subdivision 1A does a few things. First and foremost, it tells us why are we doing this at all, right? Subdivision 1A provides us with a description of legislative purpose. That's how it opens. Subdivision 2A closes by providing a threshold requirement, right? A but-for. That's not actually true. An antecedent requirement is what I should have said. Until and unless there is a parenting time order, do not move onto 2B, right? If I'm going to borrow from Monopoly, don't pass go. Don't collect $200. So what subdivision 1 tells us, 1A and B tell us, is that is the purpose of this expense adjustment, if I don't have an order for parenting time, I don't even have to do the work. We're just done, we move on with no adjustment applied. In the middle of subdivision 1 is a lot of verbiage about percentages of parenting time. Now, part of the struggle, I think part of what's generated a lot of confusion, is that under a prior version of the statute, percentages of parenting time carried a lot of weight. It was what did all the work. The court would determine a percentage of parenting time.
Isn't that still true? I mean, there's a different way of quantifying it, and there's different words. The phrase, the percentage of parenting time, quote unquote, I think is no longer used in subdivision 2, but it seems like the concept of subdivision 2 is still the same.
No, I would disagree with you, Judge Johnson. I would say that the content of subdivision 2 is entirely different. So if we want to understand by comparison, in the prior version of subdivision 2, calculation of the expense adjustment, the phrase percentages of parenting time appeared again with corresponding deduction levels. So we had a statutory term used and defined in subdivision 1A that was then used again in subdivision 2 to direct an expense adjustment. Now what we have is a term defined and included in 1A and a different term with different language that serves a different purpose appearing in subdivision 2B. And that matters.
And what term are you referring to?
I should actually say a phrase rather than a term. The approximate number of annual overnights the child or children will likely spend with parent A or parent B.
Let me, there's so many questions I could ask, but let me lay out it. HESI, you're familiar with HESI.
We're familiar with HESI and SHARE, correct.
And HESI says look to the parenting time order, and it is based on, I think, you know, a phrase in subdivision 1A according to a court order. After the amendment to the statute in 2016, that phrase still is in subdivision 1A according to a court order. That remains. I'm conscious of the statutory interpretation principle that, you know, the judicial construction of a statute is essentially as if written into the statute. We're aware that we presume the legislature is aware of all of our case law. So when the legislature amended the statute in 2016, it doesn't seem like they did much to overrule HESI. They kept the language about according to a court order. And everything else in subdivision 1A. So I guess I'm wondering if you could, where is the evidence that the legislature intended to overrule HESI on that point?
I think the evidence is in what the legislature did. So if we look at, I've got in front of me now the red lines, what the legislature amended in 518A.36,
And so do I.
You probably do too, Judge Johnson. So when we look at what actually happens to subdivision 2, right, originally, prior to 2016, Subdivision 2 instructed courts to find the adjustment percentage corresponding to, quote, the percentage of parenting time allowed. So we take percentages of parenting time from Subdivision 1A, and we use that as a defined term in 2B. That definition then flows through to 2B. What the legislature does upon amendment is it discards this term, percentages of parenting time, from the application of the adjustment, and it replaces it with language that is now fact-based and probabilistic. And this is important because the legislature has shown us in Subdivision 1A and in portions of Subdivision 2 that when it wants courts to look to just an order and only an order, as respondent argues, it knows how to tell us so. Right? And so what instead the legislature has set up is an analysis in which an order is necessary but not sufficient for an expense adjustment. It's necessary in order to qualify for the adjustment in the first place. It's necessary in order to run the appropriate calculation. We can't know who parent A and parent B are for the purposes of running this formula unless we know who has more court-ordered time. But it's not sufficient in the sense that the statute now gives us a brand new step that didn't exist when this court decided HESI, didn't exist when this court decided SHARE, to ask you to make, or district courts, to make a factual finding of the time a child will likely spend with a parent.
Is there any legislative history that talks about the ability of judges to do some fact-based analysis? Because I think another way to read this would just be to say, well, okay, when replacing percentages with overnights, but overnights average over a two-year period, we have to, you know, it's not going to be precise. So that's what likely number of, sure, I've got the phrase right, the, you know, likely number of overnights.
I would disagree as a matter of plain language.
But would you answer my question whether there's any legislative history? Because I didn't see any cited in the briefs.
There's no legislative history really in either party's brief. And I don't have, The legislative history of which I am aware is the borrowing from the Michigan statute, with both parties acknowledge. I'm not aware of any specific legislative history or floor discussion on this precise issue, no. What I would say, though, to your second point about how we read that word likely, is that likely from a plain meaning standpoint, isn't speaking in approximations, it's speaking in probabilities. What is the likelihood that this time will actually occur? And again, that corresponds and makes good sense with the overall purpose of the statute, which is to ensure that when parents are parenting and incurring those expenses, they receive a deduction in their basic support obligation. But the key to understanding this statute and the key to understanding 3.6 is that it's not a flat analysis in the way that it was when this court was asked to do some statutory interpretation in Shearer and Hesse. When you had this case in Shearer and Hesse, it was the plain language of the statute was clear. There was one term, percentages of parenting time. It corresponded with a distinct number, and district courts had no discretion to find facts. Shearer and Hesse were appropriately decided based on the plain language of 518A 3.6 as you had it. But now you have very different language. And if we treat time a parent is likely to spend with a child as nothing more than court-ordered parenting time, then what we are doing is flattening an analysis that the legislature has given to district courts that's intended to do different things, that provides distinctions in language that this court, the Supreme Court, all courts engaged in statutory interpretation presume have meaning. We don't treat language in statutes as being thrown haphazardly out there. We assume that when the legislature wants to do something different, it will give us different terms. And that's precisely what's happened here.
Now, so Mr. Bellet, I think would you agree your argument would be stronger if the legislature had deleted that sentence from subdivision 1A that essentially defines the phrase of the percentage of parenting time?
I would agree, but I can understand why the legislature didn't do it, because court-ordered time does still matter. So making findings about percentages of parenting time is still an important exercise for the district court, because that's what allows the district court to perform its first step in the adjustment formula. So without looking to a court order, the court can't proceed to what is really the functional dispute in this case, which is likely time.
And so when you say first step, are you referring to subdivision 2A?
Correct. Subdivision 2A.
Basically identifies parents A and B.
Exactly right. Yeah. And so we need to know what that court order says, and we need to care what that court order says.
But then continuing with 2B, which is the formula about number of overnights, isn't that in essence a way of calculating percentage of parenting time, counting the overnights and doing some simple math and figuring out what percentage each party has?
No, Judge Johnson, because if it were, we're essentially reading all of these different words that the legislature has used just to mean the same thing. If likely overnights means court-ordered overnights, it would be anomalous to believe that the legislature chose a different term at this point if it didn't mean the analysis to be different.
Why is the term the use of the word likely, will likely spend, approximate, why are those words necessarily inconsistent with interpreting a court order?
I would say that, to Judge Jessen's point, I would agree that the word approximate is not necessarily inconsistent when we think to things like holiday schedules and rotating vacation days. There may be an approximation here in which court-ordered overnights may still be approximate overnights, but the word likely is doing something very different, because the word likely is asking us to make a factual and a probabilistic finding very different from court-ordered. So certainly, the legislature could have written this equation to say the approximate number of annual overnights the child or children will spend with parent B under the court order, mirroring the language used above. It didn't do that. It used the word likely, which we have to assume carries meaning. If we read the statute, as respondent argues, and I think Judge Johnson, as you're suggesting, is it's all just court ordered, we're reading likely out of the statute. We're assuming it has no meaning. It's the equivalent of what's already occurred above. And that runs contrary to our basic principles that the legislature meant the words that it chose. And again, we can assign those words purpose and meaning in the sense that Of course, an order matters. Of course, an order is a threshold. But having the right to parenting time is very different than using that time.
Isn't it true that some parenting time orders leave some room, perhaps for the parties, you know, as agreed by the parties, or perhaps some contingencies based on other factors? I mean, in other words, there's no requirement in law that every parenting time order must specifically govern every day of the year, is there?
Well, I think that there is a requirement in law that a parenting time order allow a court to ascertain with some degree of certainty the number of overnights that each parent will have. And in fact, respondent points to that provision of 518.175 in their brief. I see my time has expired, but I can get to this
finish
more.
Finish your thought to Judge Johnson's question.
And because the statute requires us to be able to know that, there is a requirement that we provide certainty as to how many overnights each parent will have, then we know that likely is doing additional work. It's providing a necessary but not sufficient framework for district courts to construct child support orders. Thank you.
Thank you.
You will have 5 minutes rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, my name is Farhan Hassan, and I'm representing Mr. Nelson in this matter, who's the respondent. Your Honors, I'll address 518A36. Counsel correctly pointed out that the only way that 518A.39 would be met by appellant would be if the district court had substituted the actual parenting time being exercised instead of the court-ordered parenting time. So in that respect, 518A36 is really the fundamental issue in this case. Let me start by first talking about how these statutes really manifest themselves and are applicable in real life, starting with the Nelson case.
As opposed to where we are, the appellate court.
In the Nelson case, when the parties get divorced, we have a parenting plan. The parenting plan has a schedule. We then look at this exact statute, the parenting expense statute, and we think about the approximate number of overnights that the children will likely spend with each parent. The parenting plan defined who the parent A is, which, by the way, is my client. We then figure out exactly the specific number of overnights. In this case, 207 for Mr. Nelson. I'm sorry, 157 for Mr. Nelson and 208 for Ms. Nelson. So it's very important to understand that at some point we have a baseline. And in order to do the baseline, we have to have a prospective future-looking inquiry, which is exactly what we did here. The second issue is, legally speaking, this is an unambiguous statute. Let's start out with that issue. We have a situation where when it's unambiguous, we read the statute and we just simply talk about, is there more than one reasonable interpretation? Let's talk about a hypothetical, if I may. Let's talk about if my client, Mr. Nelson, had 100% parenting time. According to this 518A36 statute, he would still...
Court-ordered.
Yes. I'm sorry. Actually, Your Honor, not court-ordered.
Okay, fine. Because that's kind of the whole ballgame.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, but by using Mr. Bullett's logic, let's talk about that hypothetical, but instead of Ms. Nelson having 100% parenting time, my client has 100% parenting time. But under the court order, he is still parent A. He has the least number of overnights. That is a conflicting provision. The interpretation being offered would mean that my client has 100% parenting time, but yet he is parent A under the statute. Because the statute clearly defines, and we have no dispute, parent A as having the least number of overnights under a court order. So we would have a situation where Mr. Nelson would be parent A, least number of overnights under a court order, but yet he would have 100% parenting time. In other words, the remedy that is being asked by Ms. Nelson only applies to her because it's consistent with the hypothetical that's happening here, but it wouldn't be present for my client in the hypothetical that I just posed, thus leading to the second point, which is just literally applying the formula. Parent A and parent B are defined under the statute. They're clearly being defined as that you have to have a court order. And I just talked about why we need a court order, because at some point we had to create the baseline. And the baseline was approximate number of overnights. And that's all that happened here. When the legislature changed the statute, we went from less than 10% time, 10 to 45% time, 45.1, 51% time, to now averaging out parents' ability to spend time with their children on the precise number of overnights. And then it's further than that. We average out these overnights, as Your Honor mentioned, within a two-year period. Now, some parents might be traveling. There could be a holiday schedule. There could be a variety of things. There could be mutual agreements made between the parties. So that's the reason why the word approximate is there and likely is there. Because in this case, in the Nelson case, these parties came up with the approximate number of overnights that they will spend. And that was a future-looking inquiry. Of course it is approximate. Of course it is likely. Because we don't have precise numbers, because the future has not happened yet.
So, Mr. Hassan, why did the legislature not choose language? Rather than saying approximate number of annual overnights will likely spend, why didn't the legislature say the number of overnights awarded to parent A by the parenting time order? That would have been a more clear way of communicating the concept that you're just describing.
Yes, and Your Honor, another hypothetical is that when there, and this is the crux of this case, is when there is a change, then a party
Brings a motion
to modify parenting time.
I mean, I have some sympathy for Mr. Bulut's client because, you know, at the end of the day, if one side has said, well, basically the kid's all yours, then that person who's getting the kid's all yours should be getting more child support. So that was my question. So you're saying, given a circumstances like that, the remedy is bring a motion?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I guess, why is that? Is that because we're concerned that if we get into this court-ordered parenting time versus de facto parenting time, you know, it's going to, well, am I correct in assuming that if, you know, in the real world, where you all live, that would cause just more problems? Because then it's like, well, yeah, the court order says that, but I've got the kids, so I'm just not going to give you, you know, any child support, or I've gotten all the kids, and you're not going to get any now. And I mean, it's contentious enough. So is that the idea, sort of from a common sense perspective, as to why it should all be relating to court ordered?
That is exactly what our position is, Your Honor. And that policy consideration is clearly articulated in the Shearer case. Okay. Increased litigation. And I think let me address this too, practically speaking, again, which is when children don't spend time with parents or parents don't spend time with children, there's a process behind it. The process is you address parenting time. That parenting time on a post-decree matter is set under 518.175. It's best interest of these kids. It's not just who is spending time, because there could be a variety of reasons. Let me branch out a little.
But if she were to move to modify to conform the order to the reality, then that would decrease his parenting time from 157 days to zero. Doesn't that affect the threshold standard? Doesn't that essentially make it a de facto custody motion?
It does. However, in this case, Your Honor, there would be more. For example, in this particular case, and this is important here, there is a parenting consultant. The parenting consultant, as the record reflects, ordered therapy, reunification therapy, ordered the appellant to change therapists, ordered both parties to change the therapist for a minor child. We have a parenting consultant who has been given specific duties to reunify, restore the relationship between the parent and child. So then, let's assume that now a motion to modify parenting time is brought. all of these questions, the social issues, what's happening behind? Why is the child not seeing the parent? Whose responsibility is it? How are both parents cooperating, not cooperating? The best interest, so to speak, which is the standard. And by the way, in this case, it's not endangerment because the party stipulated in this particular case that it's best interest. So those are the issues that would be triggered. And I think to address Your Honor's point, that's exactly the point. It is that these are two different worlds. One is child support, and when you have child support, it's a financial statute, as I briefed in 518A39. But then when we are coming up with 518A36 and we're talking about parenting expense adjustment, the fundamental issue is, why are we relying on a version of what is happening in actuality? Whose version is correct? What's the standard of proof? By the way, what if somebody is not complying with the court order? What if it's by consent? So, for example, does it matter if my client would have said, sure, the child should be with you? Does it matter that my client says, no, I really want to reunify with my child? And of course, those things matter. And those things come out in the context of best interest in this particular case. And you know, you can have different standards of proof with respect to if the standard was endangerment, as Judge Johnson, you alluded to. But that would be my submission. And I think the point here is, if I may go back to 518A36, if the court just looks at the statute and just applies the formula, you cannot isolate subdivision 2B and ignore the definitions in subdivision 2A. It just makes no sense. It makes no sense. Because they define parent A and parent B, as I just said. We have to look at the definitions, and appellant's position would basically read 2B in isolation, and that's where the struggle is. And then on top of it, I was thinking about this, it results in a conflicting provision based on the hypothetical that I laid out. It just doesn't, and that's why it has one reasonable interpretation, and that is the interpretation that is being offered by respondent in this case. And as for the remedy, there is a remedy available, but it's deeper than that, because in this particular case, we even have a parenting consultant who is actually in charge of doing all of these things. And I understand that it might come across, Your Honors, as if that's the story. The children are not spending time with a parent. But as the record suggests, as the very detailed affidavit that my client filed, it's not as simple as that. And that's why we cannot, as a matter of course, as a matter of interpretation, as a matter of policy, simply just say to a judge, look at what is happening in actuality. Here's another question. How long are we going to look at? Under this logic, what is likely to happen? How long? Is it 1 month? Is it 3 months? Is it a year?
So isn't your interpretation, though, just making the word likely kind of superfluous? I think that was one of Appellate's arguments. I mean, approximate does the trick as far as the 2 years. So what does the word likely mean under your interpretation? That's not already assumed by approximate.
I think just the way that the phrasing is worded, Your Honor, I would suggest, in terms of at least how I read it, was that it's the approximate number of overnights, but then we have to have a probability of how likely is it that a parent will spend time and combine the two. And that could do with holiday schedules which conflict. Perhaps 1 year is a leap year when we are averaging out the 2 year. One parent perhaps might travel a lot. Maybe they make a mutual agreement. And a lot of decrees, to the judge's point, have language that says, or mutually agreed upon by the parties. So now if somebody agreed for 30 days or 60 days, is that an issue? So I hope I answered your question, but that's how I'm looking at it. I will also say, you know, even though we're not Michigan, but obviously the case was cited, that's really instructive, because the Michigan case actually illustrates that when they wanted to, they expressly had an offset language. And that offset language is, if the court is authorized to offset any the child support based on actual parenting time, in direct contravention with the court-ordered schedule. They say it. So if it indeed was borrowed from Michigan, Minnesota legislature not only had noticed, they had time. I briefed the issue of there's a child support workforce. They did a tremendous amount of work. They did met 29 times. They looked at this specific provision. They knew that they could have done it, and they did not do it. And then, by the way, I think it's also instructive from a policy standpoint what Michigan actually allows. So, for example, they allow if it's by voluntary agreement of the parties. You can offset it. So if mom and dad agree that mom should have 100% time, it's okay. They do not allow if somebody violates a court order. So they have also carved out these very specific provisions on top of, in addition to applying this. So, and that's what's missing here. We don't have, if the court were to apply and just look at this unambiguous statute, it just makes sense.
Mr. Hassan, you earlier said, I think, in response to Judge Connolly's question, that the appropriate thing for a person in appellant's position to do is to bring a motion to modify both parenting time and then child support. Is there any case or case law that illustrates that procedure?
You're on the Leak case. I believe the mother brought a motion to modify parenting time and child support. On appeal, the only issue was child support, but it was parenting time. I think the Hintz case, which was decided procedurally, the party did not do that, but that was the point. I'm sorry, my time is finished.
You can finish if you have anything else to answer Judge Johnson's question.
That's all I have.
Okay, all right. Thank you. Thank you very
much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Sun. Counsel for the appellant, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, and again, for the recording, Michael Boulette here on behalf of appellant. I think that with my final 5 minutes, counsel is absolutely right, that the appropriate focus is from the strict textual analysis to a real-world examination of what this means for parents and families. Courts heard from me as to how we think we make sense of this language so that we don't give different terms an identical meaning. But appellant also agrees that the real-world implications matter here. There is no dispute. Appellant is paying 100% of these children's expenses as though she parents them only 57% of the time. It is undisputed that respondent is receiving a discount of about $700 a month to his child support obligation for time he has not used in what is now going on 2 years. We are not fulfilling, in any sense of the word, the purpose of the parenting time expense adjustment. We are not fulfilling.
Theoretically, you could bring a motion right now saying exactly what you're saying and ask for retroactive child support and have it, you know, be, and if this continues, it's 100%. My concern is, as I've already articulated, Mr. Boulette, and you can convince me otherwise, you know, I think the danger is the farther we get away from court-approved orders, the more likely we foster problems and tension and, well, you know, this is the way it really is, so I'm just going to take the kids or I'm just going to stop paying your support or something like that. I mean, and that, I will just say, that is a huge concern for mine, that for us to adopt your position is going to cause even more problems, you know, in the real world.
So let me spend my last 3 minutes addressing
right
just
ahead,
that.
And I'll stop.
No, it's a very fair concern. So first and foremost, not to my mind, not my words, the legislature's words, right? And the legislature's determination to shift its language. But I think as importantly, Judge Connolly, if we don't make this move and we don't make this very discreet distinction between parenting time relief and child support relief, we actually create the problem that respondents saying that we don't have, right? We can take the Nelsons as an indicative example. Certainly, my client could have kicked off $50,000 worth of parenting time litigation through a motion to modify time. It probably would have, given the magnitude of the change, required an evidentiary hearing. It probably would have taken over a year. It probably would have required an excessive amount of work and legal fees for both parties. And it would have required a detailed, as counsel knows, best interest analysis on 12 different factors, maybe a custody evaluation, maybe interviews of the children. But my client doesn't want the goal to change. She doesn't necessarily even want the schedule to change. What she wants, and she doesn't want, by which I mean she doesn't want Mr. Nelson's right to time to change. What she wants is enough money to support her children while they're not seeing their father. And we see this in reverse, Judge Conley, I think, to get straight to your concern.
And you know, you're right. And maybe just by bringing that motion, that would have put the fear of God into Mr. Hassan's client, and the client would have cut a check right then, because the alternative is, well, then the kids are gone, and you know, you're toast.
Right, perhaps, but I think we can look back to the district court's order and that sense that she should not have to concoct a motion for relief she does not want to get financial support she does. And I think we can see this in reverse, right? When a parent is refusing to pay child support. Chapter 518 tells us, just because you're refusing to pay child support doesn't mean you don't get your parenting time. Similarly, just because you're refusing to use your parenting time doesn't mean you're not going to be obligated to pay the guideline amount of child support. Right? Those two rights are independent of one another, and we actually do a better job insulating parenting time and best interest issues from financial issues when we say district courts are making one factual determination. And let's be clear, in most cases, likely time and court-ordered time are going to overlap. That will be true for most parents and families going through the system. But when it is not, the district court can and should be able to make a factual finding, again, based on the court's assessment of credibility, not my client or respondent, but the district court's accepting of credibility as to what it thinks will happen. And many district courts may choose to say, I find it credible that the parties will adhere to the court order and both parents will use their court-ordered time. But district courts should also have discretion, and statute gives them discretion, to address instances in which the court does not believe it is likely a parent will likely spend with the children all of their court-ordered time and to implement a parenting time expense adjustment appropriately. For that reason, we do ask this court to reverse and remand to the district court for recalculation. And given the novelty of the issues and the fact that they have appeared before this court before, we'd ask that this be a published decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Boulet. Thank you very much, Mr. Hassan. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our decision within 90 days. We'll take